Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Josh Richman, reporter for the Bay Area News Group. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Belva Davis, the Emmy Award-winning TV journalist and anchor, the host of This Week in Northern California on KQED-TV, and author of Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. As the first black female TV journalist in the West, Belva Davis helped change the face and the focus of TV news. Her memoir offers an unflinching account of her struggle to break into broadcast journalism at a time when stories of particular importance to African Americans and women rarely made mainstream newscasts. Davis, then a young single mother, struggling to raise two small children, refused to be deterred. The fact that a racist mob pummeled her with insults and trash at the 1968 GOP convention only made her more determined to persevere. Ultimately, she rose to become one of the most respected and trusted local journalists in the country. In a career spanning half a century, Belva has reported many of the most explosive stories of our time, including the Berkeley student protests, the birth of the Black Panthers, the People's Temple cult that ended in the mass suicides at Jonestown, the assassinations of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk, the onset of the AIDS epidemic, and from Africa, the terrorist attacks that first put Osama bin Laden on the FBI's most wanted list. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Belva Davis.
Thank you.
So, as I alluded to just now, your book starts with a chilling account of that day at the Cow Palace at the Republican National Convention, 1964, a very formative moment in your career. You were an ad traffic manager, I think, at the time.
That's exactly it.
And though you had done some journalism, you didn't have formal journalism training, per se, mm-hmm. when you arrived there that day, but you left with a new resolve. And tell us a little bit about what happened there and what it meant to you.
Well, we entered not under the best of circumstances because we were part of the black press, which was not accredited at that time by the National Party. So we did something that people who are determined do. We found a man who was a high-ranking Republican, happened to be black, in fact, ended his life over here in Contra Costa County, a guy named C.J. Patterson, who was a real estate fellow who earned quite a bit of money in real estate, and was a regional chair. He got us two tickets. We climbed to the top of the gallery there and got along pretty good for about the first 24 hours. We came back the second day, and I don't know what we expected because there was lots of action, both on and off City Hall, there were demonstrations, outside demonstrations. So we were trying to record this from the standpoint of the few Republican delegates who were there because there were some things that were pretty challenging for a Republican to tolerate from what was going on in the auditorium. That was the year the Dixiecrats took over the moderate wing of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So as we were there, former President Eisenhower made a speech that under today's circumstances would not even been noticed. But for him, it was unusual when he talked about modeling criminals and switchblade knives and liberal courts who were letting people off and so on. And the crowd just sort of went crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just really let it go. And when Rockefeller tried to speak that night, there were demonstration after demonstration, and people worked themselves up into a frenzy. Mm-hmm. One reporter was arrested and drug off the convention floor. Crowds gathered at the bottom of the broadcast booths, and they were shaking their fists and yelling terrible names at these people. And, of course, part of that had to do with the fact that the television medium had been very instrumental in the South in pointing out those things that were wrong mm-hmm. and had covered demonstrations that had created some awareness of how bad it was for Negroes at that time. Mm-hmm. And so we proceeded to do our job until somebody discovered we were there. And then people started migrating our way. Mm-hmm. And we're in this corner. We're at the top. And my friend, Lewis Freeman, my news director, was always a man, before it's turned into a bad word, that stood his ground. And so he refused to hurry out. We slowly began to assemble our equipment and to start for the door, and that's when things started really coming our way. And it was all right until I could feel the flow of a bottle going past me and crashing to the floor. Mm-hmm. And I started to, you know, not lose it, but...
Your colleague told you in no uncertain terms to keep it together, as I recall, right?
Absolutely, and he had the right words. I mean, he was a man of measured humor, but he did say to me very quietly under his voice, and these lines are probably, if you ever heard me speak, you hear them, because I still find them today sort of an energy release, when he just said to me quietly, "If you cry, I will break your legs." Well, either he was very smart or something, because, of course, instead of crying, I started to laugh, and then, or smile at least. And then I thought, oh, God, I shouldn't do that, because if they're angry at us, the last thing they want you to do is to laugh about this. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we got out of there. And one more little last thing in going out, because of the history of the South, when we got to the door of leaving the Cow Palace and having to enter into a darkened parking lot, then my heart was really filled with apprehension. Mm-hmm. Because we learned from past practices that even though there were guards around, they were not necessarily guards there for us. So we made it to our car, and that's when I realized I'd been through a life-changing experience. And I recognize the power of the medium. I mean, they were just barreling down everybody else, you know, either with catcalls or drum beats or something. But the media, they couldn't control that night. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, this is for me. And never mind, I had no college degree, no formal training except for writing for, you know, the kind of newspaper that advocates for a neighborhood. So it meant, mm-hmm, I would have to learn all the things about balance. But anyway, it was a declaration made in 64. It took me a few years, but that was it.
Yeah, two years later, I believe, KPIX hired the first African-American TV news reporters in the San Francisco market, and in your case, the first female African reporter on the West Coast. So it wasn't all that long after that that you made it happen.
Yeah, I had been applying, of course, to anybody and everybody. There was one encouraging thing that happened along the way. Mm-hmm. In seeking this TV job, I actually landed a radio job for station KNEW. Mm-hmm. And I became, that again was a milestone as first black woman speaking on major market radio. And so anyway, but I came, but it's strange. They went from having no one to naming me Miss KNEW. I became the voice of the station. So life has its little quirks and turns.
Well, clearly they saw the potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to jump around a little bit.
Sure.
We'll get back to some of those early days, but I really like the fact that you juxtaposed that early, chilling, formative experience in 1964 with election night 2008.
Yes.
At the beginning of your book, and what that meant to you. Tell me a little bit about that. Set that scene a little bit, and how that sort of was not a bookend, because obviously you're still working, but another important moment to you.
It was. I mean, the fact that we selected or chose to go to a party hosted by Senator Dianne Feinstein that evening, it was also strange, because there were many parties. This was a sit-down dinner with politicos, but I guess I thought I'd pick up something that would help me in terms of seeing how they would react if indeed he did not make it,
right,
or if he did. And so my husband and I sat through the evening with a TV set that could hardly get a picture. And when we first heard that... I guess it was CNN, maybe. I can't remember right now. First station that said that he had won. I didn't believe it, and I asked them to change the station so I could hear from somebody else, and I still had trouble believing it, and the room was really subdued in a sense. And I started just to think about my parents and think about my life and the fact that I lived in Berkeley, but I lived in a restricted part of Berkeley, South Berkeley. Just that all of that was possibly dissolving away on that evening, mm-hmm. as America made a different kind of statement. And I was overcome with real emotion. And it's also something reporters guard against. So I was very happy that for that night, the tears could flow. Mm-hmm. And I just said to Diane, to my husband, I have to say something. Why? I don't know why I thought I was the trumpeter there. But in any case, so he said, well, so I asked Diane and I told her. And I just started rattling off things about my mother and my father, their struggles, their work, my mother working in a laundry for years for $4 a week, my father a carpenter getting into difficulty. And I started just telling what my life had been like up to this point and how I did not expect it, this kind of change to happen in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And in the end, half the room was crying with me. I think we all needed to have permission to be to express ourselves. And mm-hmm. the capper for that evening for me was here. Dianne Feinstein's chief of staff from Washington was a young black man, and he was sort of running the numbers down for everybody that night. And so I was sitting there. It was over, and he came over. I hadn't really met him, and he asked me, "Could I step out in the hallway for a minute?" And I said to Bill, "I'm just this." I'm going out this way. And so we did, and we got out and we faced one another, this big, tall, handsome young man. And he said, "You know, I just have to hug somebody black tonight. Do you mind?" So there we were, the two professionals standing there, you know, trying to hold it back. But so it was a very interesting occasion. That I, again, as I said, you imagine change, and when you're really confronted with real change, it somehow just didn't seem believable.
As you said, you know, you're coming at this with the context of a childhood that started out in Depression-era Louisiana, mm-hmm. and eventually brought you to Oakland and Berkeley and Berkeley High. Mm-hmm. And then you ended up first at The Independent, one of the black weeklies operating in the Fillmore District of San Francisco, and then later on to The Sun Reporter. But you had some amazing moments even at that first job at The Independent, which was less of an advocacy paper perhaps, a social advocacy paper. But a couple of interesting people walked into your office there, huh?
Absolutely. Now, this was a black-owned paper run by a black Republican man. So, and its editor was a former AP reporter who'd been out in the Far East too many years, and alcohol had driven him back home. And he was the editor of this paper, mm-hmm. and I was the face of the paper when necessary. And necessary was the day I think you're talking about when I get a little call from him to come to the front desk because there were some gentlemen there. And I said, well, you know, whatever it was, I was balking at coming, and I finally came out. And to my surprise, Minister Malcolm X was at the counter. And so now I'm in awe. I know you may have read about Malcolm X and his eyes, but they were really, really hypnotizing, hypnotic, when he fastened them on you. Mm-hmm. And what I found out was that Malcolm X had copy he wanted in our paper. But Daryl Lewis, my editor of the paper, was white. And so one of his escorts said to Daryl, had said to Daryl, that Minister Malcolm did not talk to white people. And I started to smile because, of course, he was all over the news. So he must, since there were no black people gathering the news in the places where he was, he'd been talking to somebody. Mm-hmm. But I decided if that's what they wanted, that's the way they'd have it. And I asked him what he wanted, and he that told me that he wanted to put this write-up in our paper. And I said, yes, but you have your own paper. And he said, well, he wanted to talk with, you know, brothers who didn't read their paper. Mm-hmm. And so as he said that, I turned to Daryl and I said, he said that he wants to put it in. In our paper. Yes, he knows he has his own paper, but he does. And then he said, and I don't want it edited. I don't want it changed. And I told him he doesn't want it edited and he doesn't want it changed. And we carried on like this, trying to negotiate how we could accommodate him. And there was, I continued to translate. So, until finally we arrived that Malcolm would then edit his own copy and submit it to us, and we promised to run it as given to us. And I still, I am hoping that one day I'll speak somewhere and one of the men who were with him that day will come and tell me that this was all part of a joke. And I had never heard about Malcolm X's sense of humor, but if nothing else, I could imagine them out on the street having quite a laugh.
You also had occasion, while also working at the Independent at the time, to meet a certain famous athlete, a famous boxer.
Yeah. Yes, again, if I only had a photograph. And that, of course, you know, it was Muhammad Ali, who people were still refusing to call Muhammad Ali. They were calling him still Cassius Clay, and he came to San Francisco. And for some strange reason, none of the daily papers showed up. He was speaking at a mosque on Fillmore, and I'd met him once before, but I was sent out to do it. But being a single mom at that time, I had a small child. I sought my divorce when my youngest child was 3 months old, which is another story. But there we were with this child and me and my older son, and we were trying to follow him around. And so he finally looked at me and said, you know, all but told me I should be at home. What are you doing out with these children? And ended up taking my daughter and putting her on his shoulder as we walked the streets of Fillmore Street, stopping at barbershops and beauty shops and him charming people and just being the character that you would expect. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The next time he came to town, we actually made a formal appointment to sit down, and on my website, there are pictures of us sitting on a park bench in the Fillmore talking about life. And so we had a short-lived but a very nice friendship there for quite a while. Yeah.
That image of you having to cart your kids with you to an assignment like that, happily for them that day, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, that's something that we still talk about a lot, even in today's professional world, in journalism in every field. And today, I think we talk about it both in terms of men and women. But at the time, it was more of a women's issue. We talk about the working mother, the ability to have it all or not. And how did that work out for you over time?
I found my husband. Honestly, he was my best friend and my enabler. We were not married at that period. He was the photographer, I guess, on that day. He worked with a guy named Chuck Willis. Don't remember which one was taking pictures on the Muhammad Ali day. But we were the best of friends, and eventually we were married. And we were married just in the nick of time because I landed a television job. And he stayed home with the children to give me my first year of trying to learn what I was doing. And then, as things would happen, the photography business was as discriminatory as it was for reporters. And we were able to get three photographers, as were the union rules then, to sign an application for him. And he became the first black television news cameraman in the state of California. So that's how we worked it out.
Triumphant. A question from the audience, which may fit into this line of questioning a bit. In the 60s particularly, did you feel more discrimination in the media as a black woman or as a woman in general?
Well, there's no doubt in media there was almost total discrimination. Mm-hmm. I negotiated what I call a peace settlement with one of the newspapers. There's some people here will know there's an organization called the Lynx Incorporated, and the East Bay Lynx, even back then, used to hold a cotillion for young women, and they still do. And they could never get a photograph in any of the daily newspapers. So there was a woman named Mildred Hamilton who was a writer. I made a personal appointment with her, explained the situation, and we got our first photograph of black debutantes in mm-hmm. the newspaper. So we were just shut out except for those things that people still write about now, crime mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and catastrophes. And so the whole business of gender didn't really start to press in on me until I realized that I had men I was working with who did not want to work with me for mm-hmm. two reasons, my color, and they didn't want to be an interracial couple mm-hmm. when they went out with me. And strangely enough, I had an understanding of some of that in a sense that I had to decide how I was going to either tolerate it or fight it. Mm-hmm. I knew that if I came in and isolated myself as a one against them, I was never going to get ahead in the business because I had to learn it. And the only way I could learn it were from the people who were doing it. Now, this is in the early days when the newscast had been before the recent hires, which I was one of, had been a 15-minute newscast. It was going to 30 minutes, and I'd been added on as they expanded. So here I am in a newsroom where I'm the only person beside Ben Williams who'd been there a few months, in fact, almost a year before me. And I had to learn the business on the job. And we both knew that. Ben was a good writer. He'd been with The Examiner. But the television language, the mechanics of it and all of that. But when I really understood how hard it was, and you may have read this in other places, after I was hired and there was pressure from the FCC to diversify, the news director at KGO was asked, how did he feel about having to hire his first woman reporter? And the quote that I have made famous by continuing to repeat it, if they told me I had to hire a puppy dog to keep my license, I would. He could be that open about his hostility around gender. He might have been a little more cautious had it been race, because black people in San Francisco at that time were really raising hell about discrimination on all fronts.
In that first segment of your TV career as a reporter, before you became an anchor about a little more than a decade later, what are some of the stories from that period that really stick with you the most? We're talking the late 60s and the early to mid 70s. Are there particular things that you really feel like you carry with you to a greater extent than others?
Well, it was a unique period. I don't know in this country and maybe even in any other city that there was sustained rebellion over various reasons. So there's a blur for me starting, say, in 1968. And you can, maybe even in 67, my first year started. Because we were finishing free speech. Mm-hmm. And then we went then to the Vietnam War. And then we went to Stop the Draft. Then we went to People's Park. Then we had the rebellion of teaching assistants to unionize. Then we had ethnic studies and the division of the various ethnic groups. We had the Black Panther Party on the campuses. We had Governor Reagan who said, peace at any cost to Ed Meese. Whatever it takes, do it. So it continued to escalate until finally I was on the plaza, maybe some of you boomers out there were too, where I, eventually had to have my own gas mask. I was getting gassed so often. Mm-hmm. So the era sticks with me so much. And then I also realize that if I was going to be around, I had to think of find some good things to do so that it wasn't all turmoil. Mm-hmm. And seized on something as my son has dyslexia. And I did a series on reading called Why Johnny Can't Read. And it won a number of awards. But more than that, it won a connection with the audience mm-hmm. that I was talking to. The mothers who were with children who had never understood what dyslexia was or how it worked. And to spend a week just explaining that story, the families who, for some years, as the children did better in school, would stay in touch and write notes. And mm-hmm. I know I shouldn't think every story I did was important, but we moved from that to breast cancer in women. And nobody was reporting on that, mm-hmm. not just here. Nobody was reporting on that. So I got to, I did take on during some of the earliest stories about breast cancer in women. Almost lost my job over it. But again,
why is that?
Well, I'm sort of an aggressive person. And what, there was a woman in the newsroom who was a producer by then. Uh-huh. And we decided that to save lives, regardless to what they're saying today, women had to learn to self-examine. And that, you know, the mammograms were saving lives. Mm-hmm. And when we wanted to show videotape of a woman, not without clothes, but with leotards, pressing against her breast, my news editors objected. They just thought that that was unnecessary. And Roxanne Russell and I thought it was necessary. And so we appealed this all the way to the president of Westinghouse Broadcasting. If you can believe it. But we did. And I did a continuing series for a number of years mm-hmm. going in there. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the transition from being a reporter in the field to the anchor at the desk. What did that mean to you?
I continued almost all the time I was anchoring to do some field reporting mm-hmm. because that's where I see and saw my job. Mm-hmm. Of course, I realize that prestige and your paycheck increases if you can move to the anchor desk. And so I was fortunate to do that. And I landed in my permanent position for the longest time was on the Noon News, which was, again, another wonderful thing. And I have met so many people, even in Tanzania, so many children who would say, I would come home for lunch and my mother would have the Noon News on and I would have to watch it with her at school. And so there I was in Tanzania in a bombed out American embassy and got into the embassy, which was off limits because the officer of the day was a young man in Marin whose mother made him watch the Noon News. So you never know.
Well, building a rapport with your audience is important.
Yes, it's important.
You never know when it'll come back to help you.
No.
Another question from the audience sort of ropes into the field reporting, the access that you get to things. What do you feel about the replacement of traditional news media with social networking news, you know, with the rise of things like Facebook and Twitter, as well as with talk news formats, infotainment sort of formats and stuff. Do you think there's going to be some equilibrium that's going to be reached eventually in how we deliver and consume news in this country?
Technology is so much more powerful than us humans, Josh, as you well know. They dictate to us to what we do. But, you know, this afternoon I'm on a I don't know what you call it, an organization called the Minority Media Coalition. And for many years it was founded because of trying to do something about diversity, hiring, and all of that stuff. And I was permitted by my employers to join this coalition because I said, you know, you wouldn't really want it told that you hired one person and you're not interested ever in hiring any others. Mm. And so the only way you're going to do that is to have a say. But anyway, from that organization, there was a proposal this guy David Honig made. He thinks that one of the solutions should be to have broadband, internet, all of the things that we're doing today wrapped into a teaching course that every student would get at least by the time they were in the 10th grade. Mm. Because if they could understand the technology and how it, in the context of an education, of how to use it for some good and purpose, right, other than just buzzing your friends, you know, across the table, then it can become, you know, a really, I guess, an enhancement of all of our skills. And so, and to me, journalism is part of educating people. Mm-hmm. It's just that we do it with different tools, and not unlike professors. But I think if you think about the stories that you care about and that you love, you think about them as explaining it so that people will have a better understanding. Mm-hmm. So how do we save ourselves in this period? We're being overwhelmed by technology is a good question that we're all trying to answer. I find it difficult to advise young people today about and tell them to do the things that I did because I know it's impossible. When I was doing a story that had any importance, my producer would ask me about my sources. In the olden days, unless I had on something controversial, three sources. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You'd have three sources for everything. It didn't go on the air. And now they're lucky if, I mean, look what just happened with the Supreme Court decision on health care. You know, somebody read the first page.
Right. Speaking of not believing what CNN has to say,
yes,
right off the bat, right?
So it's a hard place right now where it's overwhelming us, overpowering us, but it's also opening up a world that we could not have imagined. We could not have created what happened, you know, in the Arab Spring, mm-hmm, without the technology of the day. So that's the upside of it. The downside of it is the misuse of it. Yeah.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Belva Davis, the Emmy Award-winning TV journalist and anchor, the host of This Week in Northern California on KQED-TV, and author of Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. I'm Josh Richmond, reporter for the Bay Area News Group. Segueing out of that last question about the evolution, let's call it, of the news industry, with the industry on the ropes, economically and otherwise, as it is, broadcast and print, and with a lot of the disproportionate representation of minorities and women still remaining in newsrooms, what advice would you have for people who are, even now, as the industry contracts, who are trying to get into this now, who are trying to break through, as you did decades ago?
If I really had a really great answer for that, I'd be not sitting here. I'd be off on a Caribbean beach somewhere. I don't. But I don't. And I guess I advise the same thing, the measurement of your commitment, the same way I did my own, is that you prepare yourself to know what your own limits are as to how far you'll go, no matter what the system. Mm-hmm. You have to decide that, because in today's world, you won't have time to decide it when that moment comes unless you've settled within yourself. You know, like in the olden days, I cannot imagine a Cronkite reading something that somebody said, I've only read page one.
Right.
But, you know, it's a different world. So I advise them to be as prepared as possible. If nothing else, to be a good writer. And if you can be a fast writer, that's really good. Don't fight the intrusion of technology. It's not going to go away. I used to say that. Mm-hmm. You know, no, don't carry a camera because you won't have time to think about, if you're taking pictures, what you're supposed to write, what you're supposed to read. We're talking television here, of course. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that the technology of it is here. It's going to stay. And I think as more news people are beginning to get involved in it, maybe we'll think of better ways to use it. I'm hopeful. But you have to, you can't come as I did, unprepared. You have to have training of some sort. And you have to know how to use that camera to edit if you have to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did another question from the audience. actually a combination of two questions. Did you ever have offers to move out of the Bay Area to go to other major markets? And what kept you here?
There were not hordes of people pursuing me, but I have one good story. That's all you need. And one good story, oh, yes, and that was an offer to go to work for CBS in New York. And I actually went back from my interview. My husband and I, he was working at Channel 2 where he'd been all of his career. And I was pretty happy working at KPIX. And so we went back to the newsroom. You know, I looked through the little glass and could see Cronkite there, you know, thinking, oh, this will be great. And then we walked around New York for the day. And then I learned that reporters had to drive themselves around because the photographers traveled, you know, in there with the sound man in their own group. And we started to think about our children and our family and here. And the next day I was supposed to go in for my final, you know, look over and yes or no. And I got a call from Dave Horowitz, the guy who had invited me to come. And by then we said to him, we think we're going home. And we did. Mm-hmm. We got on a plane and we came back here. At least our children deserve to be around their grandparents. They needed some safety system. Mm-hmm. And he liked what he was doing. I liked what I was doing. And that was the biggest offer. We didn't get another. I don't think too many people go home.
turn that down. Well, but it's a quality of life decision.
But you need it really to make you feel, you know, that you did cross over. You could have had you, whatever.
I think the Bay Area ruins you for almost any place else in the country, if I can say so. One of the audience members wants to know if you've seen the new HBO series Newsroom at all and what you think of it, its portrayal of the news industry.
It's pretty tough. You know, I have to say I have only seen almost all of one episode.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's, you know, it's drama. So I don't know of an anchor person that fits that anchor person's that description, although I work with some people that came close, mm-hmm. I have to say that. I worked with one producer once who, you know, he carried a dog whistle that he would blow when he wanted our attention. So there are some outrageous people there. But I think I think it's a good thing for the audience to become familiar with. If nothing else, just what it, you have a woman correspondent who's coming back from a war zone, the new role of women and the things that they are allowed to do. That was not the way it was in earlier times. So I'm hopeful that it's not only going to serve as a as an enlightenment for our audiences, but I hope people who are interested in the business will look at it and say, I don't want to be like that.
Yeah. A cautionary tale always helps. As if the earlier groundbreaking career you had wasn't enough, you've built an institution now with This Week in Northern California. People are usually gushing about that show whenever I hear them talk about it. How did that come about, and what do you like about that format, about the work that you do on the show now?
Freedom of expression. Now you say that's a funny thing for a reporter to say. But all of us have editors. Everybody, wherever you work, there's somebody looking over your copy or your shoulder, maybe not as long as they should, but they are there. When you're on the set at KQED, what you have to say is what you have to say. Nobody's going to stop you except if you're really going off on a tangent. But I think it's the idea that that reporters could sit around and talk to each other almost, not quite as casually, but almost as open and honestly as they do in the newsroom itself when they are not on, because the format is structured to be that way. And the program was about to disappear when the former anchor quit, when it became a part-time job. And, and I volunteered to come over and work on the program. I was still working at KRON. I had two shows at KRON that I was doing, so I could work for free. And I offered to work without salary for a while till they could. But the station was in dire financial trouble. And the producer of that show, a guy named John Rosack, was so dedicated to it that you just had to love it. And this was back in the days when we didn't have the internet to go and do Google. Mm-hmm. He actually collected. We had stacks of newspapers that we clipped. And then on Friday afternoons, we'd go through the clippings and decide, you know, what we were trying to authenticate what our theme and our line and my questions and how many times we could read. Well, anyway, we had our own little process. We'd spend a whole afternoon on Friday afternoon.
And John was larger than life and meticulous,
as
I recall.
Absolutely. So I took it on first as a part-time job while I worked at Channel 4. And then I found myself working at Channel 9 also. And I stayed there even after my announced retirement from Channel 4. I continued working there. Mm-hmm. And up to now, I have found it one of the most enjoyable experiences that I've had.
And many of us, including myself, were heartbroken to hear that that era is coming to an end later this year. What led you to decide to retire from this show now?
Well, you know, I realized that Bill and I next year would be married 50 years. And and he must be one of the most patient and tolerant men on earth, because our life has been consumed with this business, all of our married life, mm-hmm. Consumed with this business. And I'm not a person who can really turn it off. You know, I'm forever reading, and because that's my kick in life. I mean, I just enjoy knowing things, and I'm sure you do too, or you wouldn't be sitting here. You have to find some pleasure in just knowing things to know them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm forever busy. Can't drive me away from the computer. And we just thought it was time to make a move. You know, I've retired before, twice. So I'm not sure the yo-yo won't come back. But I have been told by, you know, Channel 9. They always tell you that, though. We're going to work out a place for you here. We don't want you to go away. But I know that some things, you just need to move on at some point in life. And we promised each other, we love to travel, that we're going to do it. But the only way, because we've never really been big money earners, mm-hmm. so we looked upon hiring ourselves out to a cruise ship line or something where we could get free travel or something for doing a few lectures. But Bill is an adjunct professor. He loves his job. He's at Ohlone College, and he is the one now who's not ready to roll up the sidewalk. So we'll see what happens.
Very good. There was one thing, though, that you wanted to see through before you left the show, and that is the election that we're now embroiled in covering. Your last show will come after Election Day this November. Why did you want to stay on through at least then?
Because I feel I'm, in a sense, reliving so much of that early life. I mean, the 64 convention was dominated by the Dixiecrats. Mm-hmm. I assume the 2012 election will have its Tea Party element. And in a way, you have a moderate wing of the Democratic. I don't know if they have a moderate wing, but you'll have, you know, the moderate wing of the party, and then you'll have those who are hell bent on changing it. Mm-hmm. And I witnessed that once. I wanted to go back and see it again. I hope they welcome me back, mm-hmm. a friend of mine, because I didn't have a credential to get into the other convention. Actually gave me his from 64. And he said, if they give you any trouble, just put it on.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so I want to do that. And, of course, this is an unusual election in terms of, Citizen United. And it's the first election that can be purchased if that's the way it is, because if TV time dominates the decision-making the way it has in the past, money will be more important than it's ever been in any election mm-hmm. that I've covered.
You know, you talked about your deep-seated desire to know, to find stuff out. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the personal impact that a lot of these events have had on you. And this is something that I think every reporter deals with, but you've dealt with it as a newspaper reporter, a radio reporter, a TV reporter, an anchor, so many different ways. How do you separate what it means to you from what it means to the public? How do you separate out that personal expression that you talked about earlier from presenting an objective picture of the events, the news that you're trying to disseminate?
Well, you know, I hope that my life's work pattern will hold up to my belief that I've always tried to know the other side of any issue that is foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that it's a life experience I have not had. Or if I've had a similar one, I don't have the depth of conviction of belief that I think you have to bring to this business. I cannot tell someone who grew up here in Lafayette what life is like as a child. When I grew up in Monroe, Louisiana, where there was a whole different story.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do a story about childhood until I've heard what it's like somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my little world of that story. So I've always tried to find out what the other side is all about,
mm-hmm.
if it's different from something that I've had experience with. And I don't mean other side combatively,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of experience and life's lessons and all of those kinds of things. And maybe that's why, you know, I got along. I mean, I used to enjoy the moments when Nancy Reynolds Clark would invite me to the Reagan's home. And I could survive in that environment without feeling that I was an outside person.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because she had made me comfortable in that environment. And so I figure it's my job to make people as comfortable with me as I want them to do on the other side. And that's the way most of my interviews have worked. I remember sitting with President Bush One and, you know, having a really lovely chat. And I was pleased and surprised when he sent me a personally autographed note and a photograph, that how enjoyable a time he'd had.
Mm-hmm. We'll be getting to audience questions in just a couple of minutes, so if you'd like to ask a question, please start lining up at the microphone. About your interview style, mm-hmm. you know, there are some people who come in with a very strict script, and they stick to it no matter what. There are some people who are more conversational, and sort of go wherever the conversation takes them, and they find the story in there somehow. What have you found is the best way to get to know somebody and a story in terms of a one-on-one, like that talk with the president, for instance?
Yeah. Well, I do as Sidney Goldstein, who does City Arts and Lecture, said to me, you always come with too much preparation. But, you know, I do try to do my own research.
Uh-huh.
And then I try to listen. What I've been criticized for over the years is that my questioning is too soft. But I said, I'm not going into combat. I'm going in to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't fight a war with the person unless you know, of course, you know. But even with prisoners, I give them the benefit of telling me about their innocence, even though factually I can find out what the real facts are.
Right.
But if I'm going to speak with them, they ought to have the opportunity to express themselves, I think.
All right. I see somebody is waiting to ask a question.
Hi, Velva. It's wonderful to hear you speaking this evening. My name is Harriet Johnson. I'm from Oakland, California. And I have a couple of questions. First question is, you mentioned how you have to kind of, I guess, reel in your feelings when you're dealing with certain kind of topics when you're reporting. And I wanted you to speak a little more about that. Could you tell us what it is you do mentally to just not respond or react to something that's just really... tragic. that you're reporting?
Well, I mean, there are points when any human being is going to cross the line. I mean, you know, you're sitting there wanting to be very professional and not get emotionally involved. But there are going to be those points, and you just admit every now and then, and you may, maybe you haven't had them, Josh, but they do happen. But most of the time, I am trying to listen as a moderator to what I've learned about them and what they're telling me about them, and to try to find some truth in the two pictures that I'm getting from this individual. I mean, it was very, some of my early interviews were very, very difficult for people who were not accustomed to having, you know, a woman of my color in the command chair. And sometimes it's awful. I mean, I can remember a movie star, I won't name her name, who came in and we sat on the new news set, and she looked at me and she said, I like your lighting better. Would you get up and come over here? And she actually stood up. And I just got up and moved. If she's going to be on the air in about another minute or two, I don't want her to be unhappy. The lighting was not good for her there. But that's what she thought. It was Alice Faye. That's an old movie actress. But so now all of this is really comes from a drive to really want to know whatever the person who's supposed to be telling you the truth is saying to you, and then to do as much fact-checking, as much research as you can, and not to overlay it with your own prejudices, which is going to be, you know, put to the test again for me.
All right, thank you. My second question is about 9/11, and I just wanted to hear your thoughts about the media at that time and the reporting at that time, the coverage of that entire incident, and how much suppression you feel that there might have been on the 9/11 reporting.
9/11 reporting, my goodness gracious. Some of the best moments in journalism, of course, was done around, you know, that tragedy. And I don't think anyone that I've talked to who was in New York wasn't personally affected. And still, some of them still carry the wounds of feeling of helplessness. That's what I heard most about being there and feeling helpless. So, for us here, you know, we were watching it as you watched it here, but still feeling the pains for the country and hoping, as every American, that we were going to get through this. But reporters, are human. Most of them can find that place where you pocket that someplace. I'll tell you, I do remember the day that Martin Luther King was shot. And, you know, I was reporting that day, and I had to. I was, whatever was going on, and I worked very late, and I was driving home, and I had held it together all day, and I was living in El Cerrito, and by the time I got to the Berkeley turnoff, I had to pull my car over and just sit and cry, because I needed that release at that time. Even though throughout the day there'd been no tears, I've done my job, all of those things, but you're lucky if you can have that moment after there's been something horrific that's happened.
Question?
Hi, my name is Margaret Race, and I'm a biologist by training, and working with scientists, what I bump into is almost what we see in the area of technology. It's moving so fast that it's very hard for reporters to keep up with things, and it's very easy in this era when you've got strong packs that the advertising and the people that are really good at spinning things can kind of overwhelm. Take, for instance, climate change as an example. The overwhelming majority of scientists say climate change is real. Just look at the numbers, that's all. And on the other side, there's this this whole bit about, well, it might not be real. It's sort of like the tobacco and cancer connection all over again. Do you see more technically trained and scientific people coming in to help reporters in that area, or is the emphasis still very much on political news and violence and things like that?
Josh, you could probably help me out with that. Newspapers are you guys, television lives off print, which is why, you know, the businesses took a dive down when print took a financial kick, you know, in terms of laying off so many people. Science is one of the best things to report on if you have time in the business. The hardest thing to report on if you don't, because so many things have a value in the way scientists look at the world and how they talk to each other, that sometimes they forget when they're talking to a foreigner, a reporter, in explaining, you know, very complicated situations. I don't really know that. I do tell students, I said, you know, try to find a specialty that you like if you're going into reporting. And show yourself as a person who knows something about it, like the young women who are going, you know, to the Arab nations now, learning a language and getting there and calling a network and saying, I'm here and I speak the language and hire me. Not the way they dreamed of it, I'm sure, but that's the way it is now. Mm-hmm. I don't have an answer about how technology is going to impact, because even when I've interviewed some really smart people, they can't tell me because they don't know what the competition is doing, even the big guys. Mm-hmm. I know we're getting used to it. I know early on when they asked me if I would tweet, I said no. And then when they said, will you blog? I said no again. But then,
if it makes you feel better, so did I. But we both got sucked into it.
You have to. The world is that's what's going on.
Yeah.
Sorry. Not much of an answer. Like a lot of them are not at this point.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Aldrich, and I wanted your opinion, Mrs. Davis. It seems to me, when I was 20 and the Vietnam War was going on and I was taking care of young men and women back from Vietnam, that was in your living room every night. And to me, I think the American people ended that war because of the media reporting it every night. And now I compare it to the Iraq, Afghanistan. You don't see that. You don't see these boys and women suffering. And I think if you did, the American people would have ended this war a long time ago. And I just wanted your opinion on the difference between reporting on Vietnam many years ago and you hardly ever hear about it, the suffering that these people have now. I just wanted your opinion on the difference.
The biggest change was the draft. We have a volunteer army. People who generally don't come from families with influence or wealth and educational backgrounds, to compare them to the people who were being drafted into Vietnam is tells a lot about the level of... When young men go into the army, a lot of them, for financial reasons, because they don't have a job, they don't have education, or they don't have a number of things in the life, and they see the service as a way out, which is a wonderful thing. And then we started gradually getting into these conflicts. And I know when the first time I heard that people were going to be deployed 2 and 3 times, I couldn't imagine that. And the older generation, older than me, could not imagine it either. And so our whole idea about the sacrifices we're calling upon these young people to carry is so, to me, unreasonable. The logical answer would be to get yourself to handle diplomatically more of the things that we're in disagreement about. But we don't seem to be able to do that either. Mm-hmm. And I must say it was certainly useful, until Michelle Obama started talking a lot about service families, we were not paying a lot of attention to what was happening to them. But I think there is an awareness, but more an acceptance that this is the way it is in our society today. And it probably has to do with the economics of it as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And passion, I think people still have it. we just don't seem to know what to do with it. So that's why I guess we tweet.
Well, there's a difference between tweeting from Kabul or tweeting from Oakland. I mean, when you say economics, I mean the ability of news organizations to project that presence to those theaters where these things are actually happening. It's not something that we do anymore, is it?
No. That's why I was explaining that these brave young women, you know, who are in Egypt and other places, or if you look at their personal stories, I talked to one mom one day. Just, I don't know how I got into this conversation, but she was telling me that her daughter was wherever she was, and in Iraq or someplace, and that her daughter had actually taken Arabic and had paid her own way to that region of the world, and then had called in to CNN to say that she was there. Well, she didn't get hired by CNN, but she got hired by somebody else. I can't remember who. Mm-hmm. But that's how she got her job. I mean, you know, you couldn't do that before. So for her, it was a good solution, but it's not the way it should be. She should be there. A news organization should have had an opportunity to have her prove herself someplace without risking her life.
You clearly see this as a calling that needs to be resourced.
Yes,
absolutely. I know many minds have been put to work over the past 20 years trying to figure out how to accomplish that. Have you seen any glimmers of hope that we're on the edge of figuring out how to pay for news?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a beginning door, and that is to recognize that the people who write, who the original source people, at least deserve some payment.
Amen.
We moved at least to where Huffington Post, who ran, you know, up trillions of dollars for its owners, was using material that they weren't paying for, or that they were borrowing from other outlets who were paying for it. And at least there's an admission of those people who are making money off of the writings of those who want to be in the business, that they deserve to get something for it. So, Josh, when you look in it, you know, you look around for something really, 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 something to jump up and down about. We're not there yet. Mm-hmm. But that was a big victory. You know, there was there was this online strike by writers against Huffington, which is what got them as far as they've gotten in terms of being paid.
We're coming close to the point in our program where there's time for just one or two more questions. So I urge you, if there's anything you want to ask, now's the time to get to the microphone. I'd like to know quickly, given that you wanted to wait out till the end of this election, what you think the most pressing issues are that the mainstream media need to be covering between now and November in order to give people the tools they need.
Education. That, I think, you know, this democracy can't really survive unless we have people who know what participatory democracy is all about. Mm-hmm. And we know that in our urban centers, the failure rate for so many minority groups is so high that it's frightening. And until we began to value education the way it once was, we're going to be in difficulty. Because all of our, you know, talk to emerging nations was that we had to educate your people,
right,
so that they will they can, you know, read, write, and understand things. And so if I had my say, I would have, you know, the best crew I could get covering education at all levels.
Gotcha. Our last question comes from the audience.
Hi. Yeah, the news these days is a lot, or if not mostly, politics and economics. And when you look at the media, you see a great effort to be fair and balanced when the facts on the ground are skewed to one particular direction. Can you comment on that? Why is that? Is there hope, et cetera?
Briefly.
Well, we became acceptant of facts that we knew were not fair and balanced at one point because it fit our own personal beliefs. And once you make that commitment to accept as truth that which you could probably find out, as we'd be beginning to find out, was not true, then it changed the whole ball game. Then it became, well, you can only get, where do you turn to get something that's fair and balanced in the business? And we're all fighting that with fewer resources, fewer opportunities to fact check, and less financial support from our bosses to do the job. So it's difficult to find fair and balanced today, but it's certainly not difficult to find point of view. And and that is that's troublesome. And we, at least as a country, I think we're beginning to recognize that as troublesome. And I think everything has its flash in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
But I do hope that people will go back to saying, well, just give me the facts and let me decide. Because that's hard to get today.
Our thanks to Belva Davis for her remarks here tonight. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Save me.